I'm Sarah O'Connor. I work at the John Innes Center, and we're interested in understanding how plants make anti-cancer agents.
I'm really pleased to be part of this. This is an amazing program, and I kind of wish I had gone to something similar as an undergraduate. So there are many, many plants in nature that we use in medicine. And I've just shown a couple of examples here. Now, for thousands of years, really for as long as we have written records, and certainly before then, we know that we've been using plants in medicine to treat various diseases, ailments, and so on. And historically, what we've done is we've taken the leaves or the flowers or the roots of a plant and ground them up into a paste or brewed them into a tea or something like that and then taken it. We know now, probably from the last couple of hundred years, a little bit more about how these medicinal plants work. And it's the molecules from the plants that do the work, that actually carry out the medicinal actions. And as a chemist, this is kind of how I got interested in this problem. And I've just shown you here on this slide the corresponding molecules for those four representative medicinal plants that I showed on the previous slide that are actually curing the disease, curing the cancer, curing the pain, et cetera. So I want to talk about a case study of one medicinal plant. This is a plant called Catharanthus roseus, that's the Latin name, or Madagascar periwinkle, that's the common name. It's an ornamental plant. I think it's a kind of a pretty plant, so you'll often see it in people's gardens. Very commonly found. And this is the plant that we probably spend the most time on in our laboratory. We look at a number of different plants, but this is the one we've done the most work on, so I thought this would be the one that I'd talk to you about today. And I want to try to use Catharanthus roseus or Madagascar periwinkle as kind of a case study to sort of try to show you how we look at and try to understand and exploit medicinal plants today. So just kind of a little bit of a history of Catharanthus roseus. It was known for a while that people in Jamaica used a tea brewed from the leaves of Catharanthus as a treatment for diabetes. And in the early 1950s, two Canadian scientists decided that they wanted to look into this a little bit more rigorously. And so they went to Jamaica, they talked to the people, they got a bunch of plants, brought them back. And they decided that they did a whole bunch of lab tests to try to validate that Catharanthus roseus leaves had anti-diabetic activity. And basically, they injected a whole bunch of rats with extracts of Catharanthus leaves and saw absolutely no effect on blood glucose levels or essentially the symptoms of diabetes. But kind of serendipitously, what they showed was that the extracts from these ground up leaves killed white blood cells. And so this led them to sort of do a little bit more work and realize that there was a molecule in Catharanthus roseus that was really good at killing white blood cells. And this led them to the further proposal that there was a molecule in Catharanthus roseus that would be really good at treating cancers of the blood, cancers of white blood cells. About 6 years later, after they initiated this study, which is a surprisingly short period of time given the amount of work involved, they actually managed to isolate the active molecule and solve its structure. And this is this molecule here called vinblastine. And this is a pretty monstrous molecule. It's complicated, it's hard to make, it's hard to work with. It's really amazing that they managed to figure out what this molecule was back in 1958. What exactly does vinblastine do? Vinblastine binds this protein called tubulin. And then tubulin goes and assembles into higher order structures called microtubules. And microtubules are basically the cytoskeleton of the cell. And it's especially important in mitosis. You need these tubulin filaments to kind of help keep the cell in shape as it's dividing. So this is, we did not do this work. I just took this from this reference here. This is a cell undergoing mitosis. You can see the chromosomes all nicely lined up here. You probably heard about this in one of your lectures. And then in red are these microtubule filaments, you know, sort of nicely guiding the cell. Now, when you throw vinblastin into the cell, vinblastin will bind to tubulin. It's believed to sort of bind here on this spot of tubulin. And then tubulin can't form microtubules, and then the cell just sort of goes nuts. You can't really see it in this light, but basically there's just this very diffuse red spots here, indicating that the tubulin just doesn't form these nice filaments of microtubule. The cell tries to undergo mitosis. It can't really do anything because it doesn't have the right structure imposed by these microtubules, and it just gives up and dies. Tubulin is a nice target for anti-cancer agents because most cancer cells divide very rapidly. So these tubulin binders tend to target and kill cells that are dividing rapidly, and cancer cells divide rapidly, so that's sort of why vinblastin is selective for cancer cells. All right, so now if somebody has a tumor, unfortunately, and if they need to be treated in the clinic, we don't give them a brew of this tea. We give them something that looks like this, some nice purified chemical in this bottle. And so a big question is, how do we get from here to here? And there are a couple of ways. One of the most common ways is to isolate the molecule from the plant or the naturally producing organism. Another way that we're getting better at is something called total synthesis. This is a chemical method, so we just completely chemically synthesize the molecule from scratch. Another method that works is kind of a combination of these two, and this is actually how vinblastin is commonly made. We isolate not the molecule itself, but precursors of the molecule, so simpler parts of the molecule that the plant makes, and then we use a little bit of chemistry to kind of put them together to make vinblastin. That's called semisynthesis. But the method that I want to highlight, this is the one that I'm going to talk about today, is what if we identified all of the genes that are responsible for making vinblastin, and then we put them into another organism, preferably a simpler organism, one that grows more quickly and is easy to work with, like yeast. And then, so what if we could get a yeast strain, for example, to synthesize vinblastin for us? And depending on how you define this is sometimes called synthetic biology, which maybe is a term that you've heard of. All right, so what I'm going to talk about today is, first I want to talk about the first step of this process of trying to make a strain of yeast that makes vinblastin is, first of all, you've got to find the genes responsible for making vinblastin. So I want to talk about two general strategies by which we can identify biosynthetic genes from plants. And then in the last part of the talk, I'll talk about our efforts so far towards making a strain of yeast that produces vinblastin. Okay, so this is a somewhat simplified schematic of the chemistry that underlies the biosynthesis of vinblastin in plants. And I realize this is probably a very torturous thing to show you, you know, at 9 o'clock on a Wednesday morning, but Tuesday morning. But a couple of points that I want to make. First of all, the way biosynthesis works is you start off with something fairly simple. This is a molecule called geraniol. It's not that complicated. And the plant successively derivatizes and basically adds stuff to it until it makes something a lot more complicated. I also want to point out that this is a highly branched pathway. There are a lot of branch points going off from here. Catharanthus roseus doesn't just make vinblastin. It also makes a number of other molecules that are sort of side products of vinblastin, and I'm showing those on this slide as well. And then the main point that I want to make is that a lot of these arrows have no little name above them, and that means that we haven't identified the gene or the enzyme that's responsible for that chemical transformation. So there's a lot missing. There's a lot that we have to discover before we can really harness the synthetic biology of vinblastin. And the reason why there's so much missing is because elucidating plant metabolism has really been challenging. So we're looking at plants with large, I'm sure you all know by now, plants have really large genomes. They're essentially pretty difficult to work with compared to, say, E. coli. And just to kind of, again, put this into context, the first plant genome, Arabidopsis, which unfortunately doesn't make any potent anti-cancer agents, was sequenced in 2000. And by 2008, only 7 additional plant genomes had been sequenced. So this kind of highlights, really, we were stuck. We didn't have much genomic resource, sequence resource, to use to try to apply some modern methods to elucidate these plant enzymes. And instead, what we were stuck doing is something called grind and find, which is you take a whole bunch of plant leaves, kilos of plant leaves, grind them up in the cold room, and start trying to fractionate out enzymes from them and trying to follow it by biochemical activity. It's a nightmare. It's awful. And that's why not so many people worked on plant biochemistry sort of prior to this. You don't want to do that. All right, so we didn't have much plant sequencing because basically plant genomes are big, they have a lot of repetitive elements in them so far, and it was very expensive to get decent sequence for them. But something called next generation sequencing, Illumina is that's the name of an example of that, really changed the landscape. It changed the landscape because next generation sequencing is very cheap. So now it's a lot more realistic to say, hey, you know, this is my favorite plant, I want to get a genome of it. I want to get a transcriptome of it, et cetera, et cetera. And that's something that can be accomplished now for a few thousand pounds rather than £1 million. I'm not going to get into the details of how these various types of next generation sequencing work because we don't actually do them in my lab. I do this with a collaborator. You can basically just Google next generation sequencing and there will be 1 million tutorials on the web that kind of explain how it works. This is one of YouTube has a bunch of examples. But I just sort of want to put that out there that that this is a technology that's really transformed plant biology. All right, so now how do we use the sequence that we can now cheaply obtain to try to find the enzymes of vindblastin biosynthesis? And as I mentioned, I'm going to tell you two strategies. So strategy one is something called RNA-seq. And this involves not sequencing DNA, but messenger RNA or mRNA. So essentially, we're sequencing the genes that are expressed, only the genes that are expressed, only the genes that have been transcribed into mRNA and that are going to go on to form proteins. And the way that this works is we isolate messenger RNA, usually not just from one part of the plant, but from numerous parts of the plants, different leaves, flowers, roots, etc. And then we get the mRNA sequenced. And this gives us the sequence of all the full-length expressed genes, which is very nice. So now we actually have a database saying exactly what the nucleotide sequences are of all of the genes in these tissues of Catharanthus roseus. And then additionally, in addition to getting the sequence of the genes, we can also get the expression levels of the genes. So based on how many times a gene comes up in the sequencer, that gives us a fairly accurate indication of how highly expressed this gene is. So we can say, oh, wow, this gene is expressed very highly in root, but it's not expressed very much in leaf, and vice versa. And that provides another dimension of information. And the way that we can use that information is we can make the hypothesis, we can say, all right, vindblastin is a big, complicated pathway, and probably it's coordinately regulated. So all of the pathway genes are going to have a similar expression profile because they're all co-regulated. Now that's an oversimplification, but it's generally not a bad hypothesis to start with. It's a pretty good first start. Now if all of the pathway genes have similar expression profiles, if we know a few of the genes of a biosynthetic pathway, they're going to provide sort of like a big clue, a big arrow to where the unknown genes are. So we can use the expression patterns of the known genes to help us elucidate what the unknown genes are. And sometimes this is called guilt by association. And this is just one way of looking at this data. So this is a heat map. So each one of these lines, these horizontal lines, represents a gene that's expressed, and there are about 35,000 genes that are expressed in Catharanthus roseus. That's a pretty standard number for a plant. And then each one of these colors represents the expression level of that gene. And each one of these columns here going down is a representative tissue, and we've sequenced 17 different tissues in Catharanthus roseus. And then this software arranges these 35,000 genes such that the genes that have the most similar expression profile are actually clustered together. They're located closest together. And so we actually found a whole bunch of pathway genes that had been previously identified in blastin biosynthesis located here in this one little region. It's a cluster of about 100 or so different genes. And that really simplifies the problem, because if we're looking for unknown genes in sort of a field of 100 candidates, that's a whole lot simpler than trying to look for the unknown genes in 35,000 candidates. So that makes life a lot easier. All right, so let me give you a concrete example of how we used RNA-seq to actually find a vinblastin biosynthetic gene. Now, as I mentioned, this is a little bit of an oversimplification, so let me just show you the reality of the situation. This is our schematic of vinblastin biosynthesis. We wanted to focus on this late stage of vinblastin biosynthesis, so this is about the last six steps of vinblastin biosynthesis highlighted in yellow. And we knew some of the genes that were involved in it, the ones with the letters on top. And what I'm showing here is mapping the expression levels of those six genes or so across these eight tissues. And you can see that they're kind of co-expressed. They're not absolutely lying one on top of the other, but they're reasonably similar in terms of co-expression profile. There are examples where this is much better. There are examples where this is much worse. So this just kind of gives you an idea of actually what the raw data looks like. All right. Now, in addition, so this is where chemistry comes in. In addition to having all of this beautiful sequence data, a little bit of chemical intuition also really kind of helps solve this problem. So we can say, all right, we're going to look for all of the genes that co-express with those five genes that we already know. But it would really help to narrow this problem down a little bit further as well. And we can narrow the candidate pool down by focusing on a specific type of enzyme or a specific type of gene. But we have to figure out which one. And what we try to do is we try to look at the chemistry of this biochemical reaction and sort of make a prediction as to what type of gene might be responsible for this reaction. So this is the specific chemical transformation that we're looking at. So basically, we're getting rid of this double bond and we're adding a hydroxyl group here. So this has got to be some type of oxidase because we're adding an oxygen. That's pretty simple. And we know from precedents and experience and reading the literature that a good candidate for this type of hydroxylation is a P450. And in fact, what we could do is we're really indebted to organic chemists who worked on the synthesis of these molecules, because we could go into the literature and look at the chemistry that these organic chemists have done on these molecules and really come up with a good prediction for how the enzyme chemistry might work. And what these chemists showed in the 1980s was that you can actually turn this double bond into an epoxide. And then this epoxide is not very stable. And so what happens is the electrons from this nitrogen come in and form a double bond and just pop this epoxide open to form the hydroxyl group. Epoxides aren't particularly stable to begin with. Their three-membered rings are pretty conformationally strained. This really just does not really want to stick around very long. And so this is probably the compound that is formed. And then we can look at this carbon-nitrogen double bonds, and we know that those are pretty easily reduced. And so in addition to an oxidase, we think there's also a reductase that is involved in just reducing this. And then this gives us the compound that we know is a biosynthetic intermediate. So we said, all right, this is actually probably a two-part problem, but we're going to start by looking for the first enzyme, this enzyme that we think catalyzes this epoxidation or hydroxylation, depending on how you want to look at it. And again, we know that cytochrome P450s are pretty good at catalyzing these types of reactions. There's lots of precedents for P450s catalyzing hydroxylations and epoxidations. We could be totally wrong. It could be another type of enzyme. You never know when you start out, but we thought that looking at P450s was a good place to start. So a graduate student in the lab, Franziska Kellner, looked at all of the P450s that had similar expression profiles to the known vinzoline biosynthetic enzymes. So the red lines are the known vinzoline biosynthetic genes, and the green lines are all of the possible P450s. That is a discouragingly large number of green lines. That means we have to go and we have to test each one of those genes represented by that green line. It's much nicer when you only have like 5 genes that co-express. Sometimes that happens. This was not one of these times. But Franziska is very stubborn and really dedicated, and she just said, all right, I'm just gonna crunch through each one of these P450s. And she did. And the way that she screened these P450s for activity, there are a number of ways that we can do this, but the way that she decided to do it was using a loss of function screen. And basically, what we can do is we can silence the gene in Catharanthus roseus and then look to see if we've silenced vinblastin biosynthesis, if there's less vinblastin accumulating. And this is a technique called VIGS. I won't really go into the details, but basically you're using the plant's immune response to try to silence a gene if you put it into the appropriate vector. And so we can infect the gene with this viral vector, stimulate its immune response, try to get it to silence it, and then we can grind up the leaves and subject them to mass spectrometry analysis and look to see what natural products are being formed. And this is just an example where we've silenced a gene that's involved in chlorophyll biosynthesis, and you can see that the leaves are now yellow instead of green, meaning that chlorophyll biosynthesis has been stopped. So this is a nice positive control to show that things are working. All right. So she started to do this for all of these P450s. I don't even remember how many P450s it was. It was probably like 25. But when she got to I think it was the 6th one, she got a hit, which was great. So this just sort of shows you the data that we're looking at. So this is, she's ground up leaves that have been silenced with this particular gene. And she's injected it on the mass spectrometer. And this is what a negative control leaf looks like. So we've just infected this with empty vector. So this is basically wild type leaf. And this is the alkaloid profile that we see. And we're specifically looking for a peak that has a mass of 367. This is the substrate that this oxidase is going to be working on. So this oxidase is going to be consuming this substrate, and presumably the plant isn't going to have very much of it because most of it's going to be converted into vinblastin. But when she silences this gene, which we've named 16T3O for various reasons, now we see a very large accumulation of this peak. And this is very strongly suggestive that this peak, there's no longer an enzyme that works on this compound. So this compound just sits around in the plant, and that's why we detect so much of it in our mass spectrometry trace. And we can validate this sort of in another way. We can validate it using in vitro biochemistry. So we can actually take the gene, we can express it in yeast, and then we can feed it this substrate, and we can see that it's converted into the expected product. And we can characterize this by mass, we can characterize it by NMR, we can characterize it by a variety of analytical methods. And so that's how we validate the biochemical activity of this enzyme. So that's kind of how we can use RNA-seq to identify one at a time these pathway enzymes in these medicinal plants. Now I want to talk about a second strategy which has kind of come into the light probably over the last decade. And RNA-seq uses transcriptome data. It doesn't use genome data. So now that we're getting better and better at sequencing plant genomes, it's getting less and less expensive to get a plant genome. Can we use genomic data to help elucidate plant biosynthetic pathways? And I want to point out, one reason why people are so interested in this is because in the early 1980s, so I guess about 30 years ago, it was discovered that these metabolic pathways from bacteria were actually clustered on the chromosome. So this was first discovered with this compound called actinorhodin. This was actually done at the John Innes Center by David Hopwood. And David showed that the genes that encode the biosynthesis of actinorhodin are located right next to one another on the genome, essentially forming an operon. And you can imagine that if you have this so-called gene clustering, and you can get cheap genome sequence, that really would speed up the process of finding the genes of a biosynthetic pathway, given the fact that they're located next to one another. And in fact, there's a name for it. People call it genome mining. It's a very powerful technique. And thousands and thousands and thousands of bacterial metabolites, the biosynthesis has been elucidated using this type of genome mining approach. It works very, very well. So the question is, are the genes of plant biosynthetic pathways clustered on the genome? And the answer is sometimes. And so I've taken this review from my colleague Ann Osborne. And this figure shows a schematic of plant metabolites, plant natural products, that have been shown to be the biosynthetic pathway of which has been shown to be clustered on the genome. So each one of these little colored arrows represents a gene in the biosynthetic pathway. And I think, not sure if it's shown here, but I think one of your tutors has found one of these clusters here, noscapine. So we can talk more about that later. So I just want to emphasize, so this is incredibly powerful if you can get a plant genome and then you can just sort of look and see, oh, well, we know one gene in the biosynthetic pathway. Guess what? There are these, you know, seven other genes next to it. They're probably involved in the pathway as well. That's a very, very powerful technique. But I want to highlight that not all plant pathways are clustered, and we don't really understand the rules or the reasons why some are clustered and some aren't. It's a pretty extensively debated area. That notwithstanding, we thought, okay, we really should get a Catharanthus roseus draft genome and ask whether vinblastin biosynthetic genes are clustered. So we managed to get the genome sequenced with the Genome Analysis Center, which is right next door to the John Innes Center, and we got a lot of help from various collaborators. And these are all the statistics for the genome. And basically what these statistics are saying, it's an okay genome. It's very fragmented, but it's workable. It's a good first start. And we have a genome assembly that's much better assembled. So we have much, much bigger pieces of DNA to look at that's currently underway. But this was actually pretty good for the time that we got the sequencing. All right, okay, so does vinblastin biosynthesis clusters? And the answer is sort of, which is kind of I'm hedging with that answer, but unfortunately that's the case. So what I'm showing you here are some of the chemical reactions involved in vinblastin biosynthesis and also some of the chemical reactions involved in those side reactions leading off from vinblastin biosynthesis. And some of those genes are actually located next to one another. And the genes that we really paid attention to were these genes that I'm showing in white. And these are genes that look like enzymes, or they look like they might somehow be playing a role in the biosynthesis, based on our chemical intuition, imagination, et cetera. But they hadn't been characterized yet. So we wanted to go in and characterize some of these white genes and see if they actually played a role in vinblastin biosynthesis. And the example I'm going to tell you about is here. So this pink gene, this is another P450. P450s run rampant in plant metabolism. It catalyzes this kind of unusual reaction. It basically breaks this bond here to make this guy, this compound here. And next to this gene is something that was annotated by the automated software as an alcohol dehydrogenase. So now we have to say, okay, can we use our imagination? Can we think to ourselves, what are all of the possibilities for the role of an alcohol dehydrogenase in this biosynthetic pathway? And then can we test some of those possible reactions using the enzyme encoded by this gene? Now, again, just based on the fact that we had sort of stared at this pathway for many, many years, we thought a good candidate for an alcohol dehydrogenase would be at this stage here. Why this stage? Well, it turns out that all of this has been solved, so we didn't really look up here. There were a couple of possibilities for an alcohol dehydrogenase down here, which we considered and we also tested, but this is the example that actually worked. Now, how does an alcohol dehydrogenase work and what does it make? All right, so this is the second chemistry slide of the talk, and I think it's the last one. So this is kind of a crazy biosynthetic intermediate. It's called stryctosidin A glycone. You don't have to remember that name. It's highly reactive. And what can happen is this oxygen, nature loves to form six-membered rings. If you have a choice of a linear molecule or forming a six-membered ring, you're going to form a six-membered ring. It's entropically favorable. And so in an attempt to form a six-membered ring, this hydroxyl group, this is a nucleophile, this can add into an electrophile. Now, this might not look like an electrophile, but the electrons from this pi group can go up, making this electrophilic, and land onto this nitrogen here. So you get this guy. And these guys can equilibrate in between one another. And this, it's called a tautomer, so one of the components of this equilibration. This is this carbon-nitrogen double bond. It's called an imine or an iminium, or you might have heard about in biochemistry as a shift base. Shift bases are prime candidates for reduction. They're very easily reduced. We could easily imagine that they would be reduced by an enzyme like an alcohol dehydrogenase. So you'd go from here to here. And this is a known natural product. This is not directly involved in vinblastin biosynthesis, but this is one of these shunt products along the way to vinblastin, this compound here. And so how did we figure this out? Well, in this case, we started, Anna Stavrinides, the PhD student who worked on this, we started with an in vitro, a biochemical assay this time. So we could express this protein in E. coli. This is what it looks like on a gel. We could make the substrate enzymatically. So we take this molecule, which we can buy from Sigma Aldrich. We get this molecule, which we have to isolate from snowberries, which is sort of fun sometimes. Not when you're running out of it, though. We can take this enzyme, which will condense these two guys together. This is a very interesting chemical reaction in and of itself, which we worked on a long time ago. I'm not talking about here, but it makes this biosynthetic intermediate. This is called stryctosidin. And then stryctosidin, the glucose on it gets cleaved, and then it forms this thing called I called stryctosidin A glycone. And I'm not showing this rearrangement. I'm happy to show it later, but anyway, this is the stryctosidin A glycone that I mentioned. And when we make this enzymatically and we throw in our alcohol dehydrogenase, lo and behold, we see our product forming. We can characterize it thoroughly. We can really validate what the product is. We know that this is the product. This is a product called tetrahydroalstenine. And we can also show the function of it in vivo by using this silencing method that I mentioned and show that we can see suppression of this, of the lower levels of this compound accumulating in the plant. All right, so why do I care about tetrahydroalstenine? We really don't. It really doesn't have any medicinal activity. Maybe it does, I don't know. It's not that exciting. But the thing that was exciting about this is that actually this crazy compound, stryctosidin A glycone, is actually the common precursor for many, many, many different compounds that are called monoterpene indole alkaloids. So for example, this is the precursor to strychnine. This is the precursor to quinine, as well as being the precursor to vinblastin and tetrahydroalstenine. So finding this enzyme is sort of our first handle into understanding how nature controls the chemical diversity that's created from stryctosidin A glycone. So this was the first, Anna, the PhD student, really, she found the first biosynthetic gene that acts on stryctosidin A glycone. And so it's really sort of our first clue as to how nature controls this process of forming this one molecule into about 3,000 molecules. So that's why we were so excited about it. And maybe we'll find some biological activity for tetrahydroalcinene or an analog of tetrahydroalcinene. Okay. All right. So in the last part of the talk, I want to, now I've shown you sort of the two approaches that we now use, and many groups use both of these approaches to find the missing enzymes of plant metabolic pathways. And now that we have these enzymes in hand, maybe we can actually make synthesizing these molecules a little bit easier, this synthetic biology approach. And so this is this idea of, can we make a yeast strain that synthesizes vinblastine? And so no, we have not made a yeast strain that synthesizes vinblastine, but we've gotten like about halfway there. So I'm going to tell you about how we made a yeast strain that makes this biosynthetic intermediate that I've mentioned once or twice called strictosidin. So this is one step away from the crazy intermediate strictosidin A-glycone that goes off to form all those 3,000 compounds. So we're right here in the biosynthetic pathway. All right, so how do we do this? Well, all of the genes involved in strictosidin biosynthesis have been discovered. In part to our group, in part to many, many other groups, it was definitely a community effort to identify all those genes. And we can just essentially put them all into yeast. In addition to putting the strictosidin biosynthetic genes into yeast, we also have to engineer yeast a little bit. So these guys are all of the strictosidin biosynthetic genes. But strictosidin is made from terpenes. And so what we have to do is we have to engineer yeast to be better at producing terpenes, to make more of the terpene precursors, the starting materials for terpenes. And so thanks to a lot of work that had been done previously, reported in the literature, and helpful suggestions from colleagues, we identified several genes that upregulated the production of these very simple terpene precursors that are the building blocks for strictosidin. And so Stephanie Brown, a postdoc in the lab, did this. And so she put these, all of these genes into yeast. She grew up the yeast, and then she took an aliquot of the culture media. We were expecting and hoping that strictosidin would be exported out into the media. And she extracted it, and she injected it on our mass spectrometer and saw absolutely nothing. So she saw this flat trace here. These are the authentic standard. So this is an authentic standard of strictosidin here, this compound here. So this was bad news. So she very logically said, okay, there's got to be a bottleneck somewhere, and I need to figure out where that bottleneck is. So to identify it, what she did was she got the molecules that were represented the biosynthetic intermediates along the way to strictosidin. So this is geraniol. This is step one. This is 8-oxo-geraniol. This is step two. This is 8-oxo-geraniol, step three, and so forth. So she fed in these sequential biosynthetic intermediates. And all of a sudden, when she fed in this guy, 8-oxo-geraniol, all of a sudden, she could restore production of strictosidin in yeast. Now, 8-oxo-geraniol is made from this guy, geraniol, via this enzyme, G8H, or geraniol 8-hydroxylase. So this result suggested to us that G8H was a problem in the yeast. This was the bottleneck enzyme. And so to just get around this, she's trying a whole bunch of strategies to get around this, but the thing that we did initially and the thing that worked was, rather than integrating G8H into the yeast chromosome, which is what we did for all the other genes, she expressed G8H on a high copy plasmid. So we're just getting much more G8H expressed by the yeast than the other genes. Many, many more copies of it are being produced. And that managed to restore production of strictosidin. So that's our bottleneck step. And so this is, we had to put about 21 genes in total into yeast to get this produced de novo. And the yields of strictosidin, we're now up to about 800 micrograms per liter of strictosidin. That's not industrially viable. There's a beautiful example of a precursor to artemisinin, which is an anti-cancer drug, artemisinic acid, and that can be produced by yeast in yields around 25 grams per liter. So that's a good yield. So that's kind of a benchmark for what we'd like to achieve eventually. But that's not a bad start. We can also use this yeast strain to try to make more complicated products. So as I mentioned, we found the enzyme that makes this compound tetrahydroxyanisine, which doesn't really do anything, but we're excited about it anyway. And to make this from strictosidin, we have to add in this gene, which takes off the glucose from strictosidin, this strictosidin glucosidase, plus our tetrahydroalsinine synthase. And sure enough, when we put in those two genes as well into the yeast, we can get production of tetrahydroalsinine. So this, we hope this is going to be a nice system for sort of testing downstream enzymes, all those enzymes that are involved in turning that strictosidin aglycone into those 3,000 different compounds. And the other thing that we want to use this yeast strain for is we'd like to try to use it to not just make natural products, but also unnatural products or natural product analogs. And very often by using the natural product as kind of a scaffold, you can if you put little changes on the chemical structure of those molecules, you can often alter the biological activity and make them better pharmacologically or better for medicinal purposes. And in fact, with vinblastine, there are two analogs that are under investigation. They're made by the semi-synthetic method, so they're made by using isolated pieces of the vinblastine molecule that have been isolated from the plant and that had then been chemically derivatized. Vinflunine and vinorelbine, and I've shown the changes in the structure compared to vinblastine in red. And these molecules, they have slightly different side effects. They have different profiles, different selectivities against different types of cancers. So they're complementary to vinblastine. And so the question is, rather than using chemistry to introduce modifications, and chemistry is always going to be very valuable at introducing modifications, but can we also, as a complementary method, use metabolic engineering or synthetic biology to ferment natural product analogs. And so this is kind of our first stab at this with our yeast strain. There are probably more sophisticated ways of doing this that we're working on, but this is what we've gotten to work so far. So what we can do is we can feed in an unnatural substrate. So normally, strictosidin biosynthesis uses the molecule tryptamine, so it does not have this fluorine that I've highlighted in red in it. But we said, all right, we're going to try to trick it and see if we can get the pathway to take up this analog of tryptamine that's got a fluorine on it. And again, with a little bit of tweaking, we can feed our yeast culture this unnatural starting substrate, and we can see the formation of the corresponding fluorinated strictosidin instead of the naturally occurring strictosidin. So again, we hope that sort of using these combinations of unnatural substrates along with these strains that we're developing and constantly trying to improve, maybe we can make some interesting analogs of some of these metabolites. Maybe they'll have some interesting biological activity. So, okay, so I think I'm going to stop there. And I mentioned the people who did the work. There are a bunch of other people in the lab too whose work I didn't talk about. And I understand you're going to come and think up some questions for me, so I'm going to be ready. Thanks.